So I want to back up a little bit about zero mistakes, because as a company, you have to always be evolving. You have to always be growing. You have to always be trying new things. You're going to break things. You're going to make mistakes. You're going to make wrong decisions. Okay. It's inevitable. I guess what I want to make sure that the audience doesn't think that we want to run a company so conservatively that we're only going to do things that are tried and true. Because otherwise, somebody's going to leapfrog over you. So how do you reconcile innovation where making a mistake is almost an expectation? Or maybe not a mistake, a wrong decision?
No, that's a great question. You know, what you want to have is first off, transparency and trust in your organization. So we really drove transparency that anytime you have an incident, you make a mistake or whatever, report it, you know, and we didn't have a punitive philosophy. If you make a mistake and then leaders come down on you, well, are you going to report it the next time?
Right.
No, you know, so we said, look, set super high expectations, but everybody knows people are going to make mistakes. You know, so don't be scared about that, and report it and continue to get better.
Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a high performance organization, with your host, Joseph Paris.
Welcome to another episode of State of Readiness. I'm your host, Joseph Paris. My guest today is Sam Smolik. Before retiring in 2017, Sam was Senior Vice President for the Americas Manufacturing at LyondellBasell. Previously, he held the position of Global Vice President for Health, Safety, and Environment at LyondellBasell, Royal Dutch Shell, and the Dow Chemical Company. Sam recently authored and published The Power of Goal Zero to share the performance improvement concepts that he and his colleagues developed and perfected over his career. Sam is presently a board member at Axalta Coating Systems and various other companies and not-for-profits, including Ducks Unlimited. Sam graduated with a Bachelor of Science degree in Chemical Engineering from the University of Texas at Austin and is now on the advisory board of the engineering department there. Welcome, Sam. How are you doing today?
Doing very good, Joseph. How are you?
Excellent. I really appreciate your taking the time to join me in a conversation today. We have never met face to face except for, you know, virtually. But you've had a fascinating journey, and it seems like you and I have come to similar conclusions on parallel paths.
Absolutely. Yeah, when I found out about you and read about your book and your website, it was unbelievable, the overlap and the alignment that we seem to have. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, same here. So you started, if I'm not mistaken, at the University of Texas at Austin as a chemical engineer, right? In chemical engineering?
That's correct.
Excellent.
Yep, I grew up in a small town in Texas, and went to the University of Texas, got a chemical engineering degree, and I graduated at a time when the industry was really hiring a lot, and I interviewed at companies all over the United States and ended up working for Dow Chemical close to my home, so worked out very well.
Yeah, excellent. And how long were you at Dow?
Well, I spent right at 30 years at Dow. Had a good long career. I started in R&D. For 7 years. Then I moved into manufacturing. I spent a few years in Europe. That was a fascinating time. It was during the mid-90s. I was manager of process engineering for Dow Europe when we were rebuilding the East German chemical sites following the fall of communism.
Right.
And then I finished my career as the global vice president of environment, health, and safety for the company.
So 30 years. I mean, you and I look like we're contemporaries of one another. We'll say it that way. Hardly anybody works 30 years for a company anymore.
Well, you know, I always had the philosophy And I tell young people that today, to have an ownership mentality, and wherever you're working, act like you're going to be there forever. And so the things you do, you want to do things that are going to pay off in the future. And if other opportunities come up, yeah, you may move, but don't be thinking that I'm going to move, because that creates a short-term mentality, and people don't make the right decisions sometimes if that's the case.
Yeah. My father was lead engineer at IBM. And I was born and raised in the birthplace of IBM, Endicott, New York. So everybody in the entire valley owed their livelihood to IBM. And I remember when I was starting my business in 1985, just out of university, but then IBM had a challenging time, and he ended up taking an early retirement. And, you know, IBM's footprint in the valley went from like 25,000 employees to a little over 200 employees over the course of the coming decade. So, you know, sometimes, you know, forever is never as long as you think it's going to be. And here I am still running my company, you know, some 30 years later. So
that's a fascinating story. It says a lot about you.
Yeah, you know, it's just, and, you know, I've had to reinvent myself a couple of times. You know, from what we started as to what we are today, of course, is, you know, there. Someday I'll write a missive about that, you know, but one of the things that I've always thought about is that once technology becomes a commodity, then the services of that technology soon become a commodity afterwards. And it's, you know, I think Jack Welch said it, unless you're number one or number two, you got to get out. And so you don't ever want to be in a commodities type business. Well, I mean, you're in the chemical industry and the oil and gas industry, so you know the pushes and the shoves of the fickle markets.
Yeah, but you know, the principles in my book, which we'll get into later, it applies to specialty type businesses, but also commodity, because at the end of the day, you want to be the very best at what you're doing. If you have competitors and everybody else is good, you know, you want to be outstanding, and you can always differentiate even in a commodity market.
Right. So after, so you're 30 years at Dow, and then you went on to Shell.
Yeah. Well, like you say, 30 years, you think it's a long time, but I was prepared to be a long time, you know, full-time Dow employee my entire career. Never thought about leaving. And I was serving as the global vice president for environment, health, and safety in Midland, Michigan. And Shell came along, and they had some problems with the SEC and how they accounted for oil reserves. This was back in 2003. Mm-hmm. And SEC came down.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, it was devastating for the company. And so they came out hiring guys like myself to create global functions. They saw what we had done at Dow Chemical, and they offered me a job. And I said, "Where's the job?" And they said, "London." And I said, "Hey, that's great. I've lived in Europe. I love Europe. But, you know, quite honestly, the only reason I would ever consider leaving Dow would be to get back to Texas." And they called me back and said, "You can do the job in Houston." And so I said, "My goodness, okay." So suddenly I said, well, I could live where I want to, do the same thing I've been doing, and of course, negotiate a little bit more money. And so I made the hard decision to leave Dow, and I went to Shell and led their global environment, health, and safety for the downstream business. So we had all the retail stations, the refineries, the airports. You know, I loaded a 737 airplane one time in Amsterdam. And, you know, just a lot of fun business to be in. And we did a lot of great things at Shell.
So how did you get from chemical to environmental health and safety?
Well, I was running plants after my R&D days and after my stint, actually before my stint in Europe, I ran manufacturing plants. So I ran a toluene diisocyanate, a polycarbonate, EDC, vinyl chloride. I ran wastewater treatment plants, and a lot of different hazardous facilities, to where you're dealing with hydrochloric acid and ethylene and phosgene and things that you have to do. You have to do it right, or you can get into trouble really fast. And I developed a reputation of being able to take a poor running facility and turn it around and improve reliability, improve morale in the sites, and profitability. And so as a reward, I'd get moved to another bad facility to improve the performance. And so in 2000, I surprisingly got a call, and they wanted to offer me the global VP job for EH&S. And at the time I said, well, who did I make mad? You know, I'm a line guy. I like manufacturing. And the company had realized at the time that they needed somebody to come out of the manufacturing line in order to help the facilities around the world, but also to know where to push. You know, so I call it a kind of a combination of challenge and support. Right. And it really turned out well, because instead of me having accountability for plants, individual plants, now I had accountability to improve the performance, to help improve the performance in plants around the world.
Right.
And that was an entirely different mentality and approach, and I really enjoyed it.
And that Shell experience is how you ended up at Lyondell-Basell?
Well, so I was living in Houston for Shell, and they continually wanted me to move to The Hague and to London, where they ran the downstream business. And, you know, my children were grown up in Texas. And at this point in my career, I had no interest in moving, although I traveled all the time. You know, I didn't mind that at all. Well, Lyondell-Basell, which it was a joint venture, Basell, between BAS and Shell, a chemical company, independent company, bought a publicly traded company, Lyondell, in the beginning of 2008, just when everything cratered.
Right.
And after 1 year, and so they brought a new CEO in 2009, and he tracked me down and wanted me to come work for the company to do the same thing, you know, to run the global function. And my first question was, why would I leave Shell and go to a bankrupt company? You know, if we can't do things the right way, then I don't want any part of it. You know, if we're taking shortcuts for safety or reliability, I just don't want that. And he assured me that we're going to be the best company in the industry, and we'll put our first dollars towards operations and safety. And I said, okay, if you don't hold your word, I'm out of here. And I tell you, he never failed. You know, we took that company, and today it's, you know, I would say it's one of the best operating companies in the chemical industry, Lyondell-Basell. The annual safety rate, TRIR, is about 0.20, you know, which is top decile performance of the industry. And so a lot of things we did, which I put in the book, paid off. And the company stock, after we got out of bankruptcy, we emerged at $17 a share, and we hit a high of $115. You know, so, you know, the principles for operational excellence and safety and quality, they all go together, and it creates value for your company. And we demonstrated it.
Right. So you retired from them in 2017, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct.
Yeah.
I spent 7 years at Lyondell-Basell. Actually, the last 2 years, I ran manufacturing. Okay. Right. So I did full circle after almost 20 years of environment, health, and safety across the world. I ran manufacturing. Then I retired in 2017. And since that time, I've served on two company boards and some nonprofit boards. And then did some consulting. You know, a lot of times I consulted with a chicken production company. It's the sixth largest chicken company in the country. They process 2 million chickens a day, if you can imagine, 2 million chickens a day. And we applied the same principles there. And I get notes from those guys. They say it changed their company. It changed how they approach culture and safety. You know, so the principles apply across all industries.
I'm smiling, almost laughing here, because you're mentioning chickens. And I was going to South Africa quite often. I have some friends there, and we had some work there. And we were driving from Durban to the Drakensberg Mountains. And it's miles and miles of sugarcane and chicken coops. I mean, you know, these large, you know, industrial chicken farms. And we're going through this, you know, for hours. And we come across a chicken coop, and on the side of it, in big letters, says, "Please don't honk your horn. The chickens are sleeping." Now, for 2 hours, we never thought about honking our horns. You know what I mean? And being impetuous, you know, people, and the Africans, the South Africans, the next thing you know, they're starting to toot their horns. Anyway, I just wanted to share that because you mentioned chickens, and it was kind of funny at the time.
I've spent a lot of time in South Africa. It's a wonderful country. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it is. You know, we could probably talk about South Africa for hours. I mean, I found it a most fascinating country, and fascinating people, and just, you know, everything was just amazing. So I found out just
like you have, Joseph, that facilities around the world, people are people, and they may have different cultures and different habits. But China, for example, I've seen some of the worst running plants and some of the best running plants. And Latin America and Europe. And so it's, you know, it gets back to expectations and leadership and doing the right thing. So that's what I found working globally is people around the world can deliver.
It's amazing. You know, when I travel, you know, I've walked the earth like you have. What I've discovered is that the challenges that people and companies face are the same no matter where you are in the world. But how people approach those challenges are very local, and almost they problem solve the way they are brought up. So, for instance, when I was in Africa, if something broke, they fixed it with coat hanger wire, WD-40, and duct tape. You know, they hardly ever had the opportunity to get the proper part, but they had to get the machine working. A German will see that same problem, and they'll implement a solution that some archaeologist will discover 10,000 years from now, it'll still be working.
And
Americans don't think things all the way through. You know, and it's just, you know, but I think, you know, I think that's actually one of the strengths of American companies is that you look around the board room or the management, and you have a diversity of backgrounds, and everybody's looking at these challenges from their own perspectives. And, you know, some of the innovations that come out of that are, you know, pretty remarkable.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. In fact, in Germany, like I said, we rebuilt the East German chemical sites towards the end of communism. They just didn't have any money and any funds. And so they repaired things the same way with duct tape and baling wire. And, you know, it was amazing what they accomplished with so few resources.
Right.
And so you're right. People are, you know, they operate depending on their surroundings, and they do what they can do with what they have to work with.
Yep.
So, innovation. I've seen incredible things come from all around the world, and I always thought if you can just collect all these best practices and pull it into one system, then you've got it. I mean, you're taking advantage of everything that's out there.
So after you retired, you decided you needed to write a book, The Power of Goal Zero. What is Goal Zero? Why don't you share that with the audience first?
Well, I have a picture of the book, the actual book right here.
Yeah.
I published it in June of this year, June 2021. So I didn't decide to write the book when I retired. I guess I had always thought about writing a book, but I never had the time to sit down and do it. I mean, it takes, as you know, it takes hours and hours and hours. And so I would consult with people. I would attend seminars and sessions, and I would see the same problems occur over and over again. You know, people say, well, these people just aren't following the rules, you know, or they're making a mistake that we made 2 or 3 years ago, or the talent's all going out the door with retirement. I mean, you just hear all these things. And I'd always think to myself, we solved that already. You know, we've already learned how to deal with that issue. And so what triggered me to write the book was COVID. So when COVID occurred, it started getting pretty heavy in the beginning of 2020. I remember around March that all the travel stopped, and I was always busy and loaded up with things to do, either hunting or fishing or doing things with my friends or going to board meetings. And suddenly that just came to a halt.
Yeah.
And we have a weekend home down on the Gulf Coast, and to get out of Houston where I live, we just went down there. We spent all of 2020 in a small little town because, you know, fewer people and you're safer. And so one night I was lying there, I said, you know, if you're ever going to write a book, now's the time. And so it was perfect. You know, I sat down and I started capturing my thoughts. And I wrote it essentially from March, no, I guess from April to August. And it just flowed. It was no problem with the content. It was all based on my experiences and what we had done to improve performance. And then we did some reviews and you know, I ran it by a lot of people, and you know, they taught me how to write in real English. And I published it in June of this year. And, you know, my intention was to help others. You know, you're never going to have a New York Times bestseller in this kind of industry, and your return, your dollars per hour of writing is probably about 29 cents an hour, if that much. And so the whole thing was, if I can put that out there and it can help protect people or help organizations to be better, be more productive, have better quality, then, hey, it's worth it. And what gives me the most joy is when I get feedback and people say, wow, you know, this changed our company, or this changed my whole approach to things. That's very gratifying. You know, so I enjoy that a lot.
Yeah. You know, when I was, I had a publisher, and I was getting towards the end of the cycle, you know, end of the effort, and mine took considerably more time than yours. But I, you know, I wasn't locked in a hideaway house during COVID either. So I guess that, you know, I had to parse my time between writing and working. But it gets towards the end, and you have all this work that you've done in it, and it's like, is this any good? Yeah, and my publisher, you know, suggested that I send it out to other authors and consultants to see how it resonated with them. And I'm thinking, I really don't care what another author or consultant thinks about my book. It's like, I want, you know, operations people, I want, you know, business leaders to weigh in. And I didn't want an Uncle Tony just patting me on the back saying, nice job, Joe, nice job. So it had to be an arm's length. And, you know, the people I sent it to, and the criterion was they had to be senior leaders of industry, and I could never have met them before. That was my criterion. And yeah, the feedback I got was very, very positive, and it's been a positive experience. And I'm sure that yours is, I'm sure you must be happy with the results of your book, not just in raw sales. Cause as you said, you know, we're not going to be billionaires like Rawlings, right? I mean, we want to make an impact with our books. And I really, really enjoyed reading your book. I think it's outstanding. And there's a lot of commonality. And it's interesting. There's a lot of commonality between some of the things that you think and do and the, some of the things that I think and do, even though we came from parallel universe. You know, we never intersected before, you know, before we set up this interview. So I thought that was quite interesting. But have you been, you know, happy with the results? Has it been as impactful as you expected?
Well, I think I'm convinced that I could create a consulting firm off of what I've written, because I get calls all the time about, can you come talk to our company? And which I have done some. And I will for the right opportunities, but to speak at seminars and conventions and, you know, all over the world. But, you know, I'm almost 70 years old now, and I like a balanced life.
Yeah.
And so I'm doing a measured, approach to this. You know, I'm doing a few of these calls like I am with you. If it's a quality group and quality organization, and then the response is always, I always get calls then and say, hey, can you come speak to this group, or can you do this or that? And so I find it rewarding to, and it keeps me engaged in what's going on. So I have to do it at a measured pace, but let me talk a little bit about what's in the book.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
Kind of my approach to excellence. You ready for that?
Yeah, I'm ready. I'm strapped in. I'm ready to go.
Okay. So, like you say, there's so much in common in our books, and, you know, I don't claim to have all the answers, and you don't either, but we do have a proven method for how to do things. And so through the years, when I first began kind of an EH&S role, I would approach safety kind of separate from quality. You know, you'd have a quality organization, a safety organization. You might have a process safety team, and then you had manufacturing and HR. And what I quickly realized was you had barriers that you had to overcome. And if you're trying to implement a culture in a company or some processes, you've got that kind of built-in interference within an organization, if there's not somebody at the top that's saying, look, here's how we're gonna do things. Okay. So I learned that during my days at Dow, and I would put Dow against anybody from a manufacturing point of view. You know, we had very strong centers of excellence. We drove consistency globally. And so I learned a lot when I was at Dow. When I went to Shell, it was a different story, because Royal Dutch Shell had been a joint venture since the beginning. Okay. And it didn't become a company until 2005, a year after I was there. So the Shell system was one of a parent joint venture. And then you had operating companies down below, which had a lot of autonomy. They could decide how they did things. Now, you had some corporate centers, but they were more of influence and suggestion and recommend, as opposed to saying, here's how we're going to do things. And so I saw the big extremes between Dow and Shell. Now, Shell since then, and like I say, it's why they brought people like me in to build some global functions and drive some consistency. Man. Okay. When I got to LyondellBasell, the company was bankrupt and, you know, flat on its face. And the CEO, I was reporting to the CEO, and we agreed on what we wanted to do. Well, I had an opportunity to help shape it from the very beginning. And so what we did, which is kind of unique, I was head of vice president of operational excellence. So EH&S and operational excellence. And the way we define operational excellence is that's the way we do things around here. Okay. It's our management system, which included all of the functions. So one of the brilliant things we did was I created an operational excellence leadership team. And I had the heads of manufacturing on my team. I had the head of HR. I had the chief legal counsel on my team. And then a business leader, one of our functional businesses, to be on my team. So normally you got EH&S that's subservient down in the organization. You know, I was leading the team of how we're going to achieve operational excellence in the company. Because if you're creating standards or processes, things you're going to do, a lot of times there's a cost component with it. And so I wanted to make sure before we developed something and agreed to it, that I had manufacturing and the business on board with it. And of course, legal, they always say, look, if you write it down, you better do it. And so we rebuilt our management system. We greatly simplified every document because they were all too long and bulky and impossible to comply with. So, you know, one of the things we did was built a management system that was easy to understand for the people and they could comply with it. Okay. So that's the system element. We also worked on culture. In culture, we created a culture we call Goal Zero. And that's the title of my book, The Power of Goal Zero. And the whole philosophy is you want zero defects in what you do. You want zero incidents. You want zero rule breaking in your people. And
so let me just, because you said zero defects. I want to just drive this point home to the audience because I think it's important. You know, most people in manufacturing think defects and they think in the manufacturing process, but you're talking about zero defects in everything they, you know, think, do, or say. I mean, just everything. Is that correct?
Zero mistakes.
Yeah, zero mistakes. Yeah.
Now, when you say that, which I said that's what we're going to do day one, because we started that concept when I was at Shell. Day one, I said, we're going to be a goal zero company. Well, the natural response is that's impossible. There's no way. Okay. A large company can be that way. And I'd say, yeah, but you have to make it personal. It's about each one of us operating in a goal center each and every day. So for example, Joe, you and I can you and I work today and not break any rules? Can we be very careful to not get hurt? Can we double check our work so we don't make any mistakes? And can we operate in a goal zero manner today? What would you say?
I would say yes.
Yeah. And most people will. They'll say, yeah, we can do that. And that's the whole point, is that if each of us throughout the whole company work that way today, and then we work that way tomorrow, we have a real chance to become a goal zero organization. And it's amazing. It takes a lot of communication and a lot of, we had workshops. We talked it over and over. We had little themes like goal zero begins with me. Mm-hmm. We had every person say goal zero begins with me. And after a while, people start to say, ah, this is possible. And it's amazing. If you look at all the parameters, like a process safety incidents, I mean, we cut that down like 80, 90% within a year, year and a half. The safety rate, like I said, is consistently below 0.2. I mean, we won the American Chemistry Council Company of the Year award a couple of years, you know? So this kind of leads into the five elements that I think are important for operational excellence in my book. It's the system that we talked about, simple procedures, requirements, simple examples. You have to have culture. And I say goal zero. Some companies say target zero. You know, nobody gets hurt. Driving perfect excellence, you know, driving excellence. It doesn't matter what you call it. It's the philosophy that counts. So once you get your systems and your culture right, and in a manufacturing organization, maintain your facilities, in good shape. Then it all comes down to leadership and people. And these things, your system and your culture, are enablers for leaders and people to execute to perfection. And let me make a comment here, just a story about perfection. Well, nobody's perfect, right?
Right.
And Vince Lombardi, you remember the famous quote? Yeah. He was a football coach.
Yeah.
He said, we are going to strive for perfection. That's what he told his team. They were Super Bowl winners several years. So we're going to strive for perfection. He said, now, nobody's perfect, but along the way, we're going to hit excellence. And he said, I have no interest in just being good. And I love that. You know, what company just wants to be good? You know, strive to be perfect and hit excellence along the way.
So I want to back up a little bit about zero mistakes, because as a company, you have to always be evolving. You have to always be growing. You have to always be trying new things. You're going to break things. You're going to make mistakes. You're going to make wrong decisions. Okay. It's inevitable. I guess what I want to make sure that the audience doesn't think that we want to run a company so conservatively that we're only going to do things that are tried and true. Because otherwise, yeah, Somebody's going to leapfrog over you. So how do you reconcile innovation where making a mistake is almost an expectation, or maybe not a mistake, a wrong decision?
No, that's a great question. You know, what you want to have is first off, transparency and trust in your organization. So we really drove transparency that anytime you have an incident, you make a mistake or whatever, report it, you know. And we didn't have a punitive philosophy. If you make a mistake and then leaders come down on you, well, are you going to report it the next time?
Right.
No, you know? So we said, look, set super high expectations, but everybody knows people are going to make mistakes, you know? So don't be scared about that. And report it and continue to get better. Now, if you just, you know, I've seen many times in a production plant, somebody goes out and grabs a valve and they turn the wrong valve. It shuts down the plant or causes a problem. Well, we always tell people, look, that's the kind of mistakes we really don't want. We want you to go out, look at the valve, take a second, say, okay, is this the right valve? And then operate it. You know, there's just, if you kind of condition people to just take that extra moment, you can help minimize mistakes. Right. So you're right. You're right. It's how you do it. You know,
right.
A poor manager would come out and say, I expect zero defects, you know, and if you do, you're in trouble. Well, if anybody ever has that approach, don't tell anyone you read my book, you know, because that's it's about.
It's funny. There's a couple of things that that come to mind. First, when I'm evaluating people or I'm coaching, others on evaluating people, I tell them that if somebody hasn't made a mistake, they're either not trying hard enough or somebody else is getting the blame. Okay, those are the only two things. I mean, so you know, pushing the envelope, not recklessly. Okay, within, you know, operating parameters, not recklessly, but pushing the envelope is where you're going to find your growth. But when there is a mistake, it's not just enough to be transparent and report it, but it's important to figure out why it was a mistake. You know, so I'm very heavy on the debriefs. You know, after an engagement, even if the engagement is wildly successful, there's always an opportunity for improvement. What might have we done differently and why? And, you know, or if something didn't go according to plan, you know, dig into it. And it's like, why didn't that happen? So I think that we have to add context to the mistake in order to grow from it.
I think you're right on. Yeah, you have to be a learning organization. That's why, you know, the old plan, do, check, act cycle.
Yeah.
We talk about that a whole lot. You know, the plan is you've got your system, your expectations. You go out and you execute. But then you check along the way, you investigate incidents, you have metrics, whatever. Right. And then you determine gaps and you learn from it and you make changes as you get better. And, you know, one of my favorite leaders, I'll just give you an example, is Nick Saban. So Nick Saban, American football coach of Alabama, he's won, I think, 7 national championships. He's, you know, he's the best college football coach out there. Now, right. Nick Saban.
He just recently lost a game, right?
He lost a game, but he's in the, he's going to be, he's in the top 4 teams for the national championship again this year.
Yeah. But they had such a long winning streak. Yeah.
Oh, he's incredible. And, you know, sports and business, you can learn a lot from each other. And I've studied a lot of sports coaches as well as industry leaders through the years and say, you know, how do you motivate people? How do you get them to perform their best? Nick Saban, if you listen to him when he's talking, he always talks about his system. You know, we have a system for how we do things at Alabama. And if he hires an assistant coach to come in, he doesn't want that assistant coach coming in and bringing his learning and teaching things his way. He says, I want you to come in and learn my system so you can coach to our system. Now, if you have some better ways to do it, let's update our system. Okay. So he doesn't want, you know, companies, a lot of times they'll hire a new plant manager and they let that plant manager just go run the plant the way they want. Well, then you're only as good as those people, those individuals.
Right.
And you don't drive consistency and quality across the organization. Now, Nick Saban instills that in his players. He said, I expect you, all you can do in a football game is execute the next play to perfection. Okay, so he expects a goal zero mentality on every play. Well, football players make mistakes. You know, they have penalties and whatever. And he just, you know, he probably gets a little mad at them, but hey, let's continue to strive for perfection. You know, and that's the mentality that says, hey, you're going to take chances, you're going to take risks, but overall our fundamental foundation is here's how we do things. And we expect excellence.
Right. It'd be a lot more predictable if the ball wasn't that funny shape.
Yeah. We're talking American football.
Right. Yeah, that's right. You know, so. Well, listen, Sam, I think, you know, we should probably wrap it up. I want to thank you again for taking the time and sharing your journey first and foremost. I think there's a lot of wisdom in there, and also the concepts behind Goal Zero and how you came to embrace it such and express it in your book. And they could buy that book on Amazon, right? Is it paperback, Kindle, hard copy?
It's a Kindle, paperback, and hard copy. It's on Amazon, but it's on Barnes and Noble and other, you know, other online sources. basically I wrote it to help other people. That's what it's all about. And, you know, and I tell you what, I've always thought if I read a book and come away with one or two tips, it was worth it. I guarantee I'll give anybody their money back if they don't come away with a number of tips.
Well, I came away with several, you know, not just the reinforcements of some of the things that I thought, but, you know, your wisdom really does come out in this. And I think most important, it's an easy read. It's an approachable read. You know, I did not struggle to go through the book. And I think that you did an outstanding job of getting those ideas across. And I think that any leader, business leader or aspiring business leader will gains from your wisdom in this book.
Well, I appreciate that very much. Your book, I'd say exactly the same things. It's very complimentary. So yep. If people read both of our books, I think they're going to be way ahead of the game.
Very good. Well, thank you again, Sam, for joining us. Again, folks, you can get the book from Amazon.com or wherever books are sold.
Thank you for listening to State of Readiness.
You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at www.josephparis.me/card.